political cesspool known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Well, I hope nobody's disappointed. Don't mean to disappoint anybody, but James Edwards is off tonight. He's off on a short holiday with his wife, and filling in for him tonight is your host, Bill Rowland. So good evening to everybody, and glad to have you listening to the show. And with me tonight, the Venerable Keith Alexander.
Tell you, it sounds it's a little spooky to hear Frankie Valli. We always link him with James so much, but you know this is one of his rare vacations, and we're privileged to be here filling in for James as best we can.
Well, of course, James is an impossible act to follow, but the best I can do is sort of be the co-pilot on this show. And but I'm always glad to do it, and of course. Tonight we have some excellent guests. In addition to our regular Keith Alexander, of course, with his outstanding and trenchant commentary, tonight Brother Nathaniel Kapner will be joining us in the second hour. And Brother Nathaniel, as many of you know, was the one of the top choices for guests on the show. I think Brother Nathaniel came in fourth or fifth. So Brother Nathaniel will be joining us in the second hour. We look forward to that. But let's get right into it, Keith, with what's going on. Particularly, I guess tonight is going to be Memphis night in terms of discussing politics and current events. And two things that you want to discuss in particular, I know one is the ongoing school consolidation crisis here in Memphis, which we want the whole country to hear about this. This is what happens when a third world population takes over a first world city. And the second thing, of course, being a renewed attack on Confederate history and Confederate heritage, this time in the person of General Nathan Bedford Forrest. And Keith, we'll be talking about those two things. But first, the school consolidation crisis in Memphis.
The school consolidation crisis in Memphis is something that we're featuring. I started this segment out years ago calling it Behind Enemy Lines, because we would take a newspaper article or another article of current interest and then unpack it and break it down. And particularly things like these public school consolidation battles are just freighted with all sorts of racial overtones, with all sorts of liberal overtones that basically people are conditioned to overlook or not understand fully. And we try to break through the cant and, you know, really target what's going on so that people can understand it. Of course, another thing we're going to talk about, too, if we have time, is that the inimitable TUIs have shown up again. They have managed to parlay their near escape from the NCAA authorities in the, courtship of Michael Orr, the now Baltimore Ravens first-round draft pick tackle, into a motivational speaking career for Leanne Tuohy. It's been a best-selling book, then it was a best top 10 movie, and now the Tuohys have a continuing, gig going with this thing with motivational speaking, along with all of the rest of the neocons that you would expect, you know, the usual suspects. But let's get, first of all, to the Memphis and Shelby County school consolidation matter. For those of you who may not be aware of this, the Memphis City Schools have surrendered their charter. They supposedly no longer exist. Now, the Memphis City Schools are 89%, is it black now? 89% black. Back when they first integrated, back in the 60s, in the early 70s, it was, I think it was 53% white, 47% black. And, of course, white flight has taken hold, and where have the whites fled? To all the outlying areas. Memphis is geographically peculiarly situated. It's right in the corner, the southwest corner of Tennessee. So it's near Arkansas, it's near Mississippi, and of course, it's in a very large county called Shelby County. Well, the first flight area is Shelby County, and that's where a lot of white people have gone. Now, as things have developed, Shelby County's school system, which is separate from the Memphis school system, has basically developed a very integrated school system. I think that basically it's like 53% white, just like it used to be in the Memphis school system, and it's 47% non-white, 35% black. Now, the Memphis City School System is, one, lavishly funded, and two, horrible in terms of academic achievement. The state report card, which goes out for all schools, set by the state education department, gave the Memphis school system all Fs except for one D. On the other hand, the really thoroughly integrated Shelby County school system got all A's except for one B on the state report card, which is one of the highest rankings in the entire state. Of course, the Memphis school system is considerably larger than the Shelby County school system, and the Shelby County school system is run on a kind of bare bones basis. Basically, they have 30% of the students in the combined school systems, but they pay 40% plus of the cost of running the school systems. And what provoked this latest flurry of activity was that the Shelby County school system, now that they have a Republican majority in the Tennessee legislature, was going to pass legislation that would have allowed them to basically secede from this unholy matrimony that they had with the Memphis City school system. And they were going to basically be able to use all the money outside of the city from property taxes that were earmarked for public education to finance their school system. And, of course, what it gets down to, again, is race. The Memphis City School Board, which is vastly majority black, with people with names like Martavius Jones, basically didn't want to see the white people's money get out from under their control. So, in a desperation move, they surrendered their charter. Now we're going to have a referendum coming up in early March where the people of the city of Memphis alone, not the city and the county, but just the city of Memphis, are going to vote as to whether or not they're going to ratify this charter surrender. And if they do, then the ball is back in the Shelby County's court, where Shelby County state legislators have introduced and passed legislation.
Coming up on break, we'll be right back.
Don't go away. There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages. Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
And thanks for staying with us, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Bill Rowland here with Keith Edwards, and welcome back. Excuse me. With Keith Alexander.
Keith, okay, Edwards. I feel like Rodney Dangerfield.
No respect. With Keith Alexander. And welcome back to all of you listening on AM 1600 in Memphis.
Brand X, in other words.
Brand X. And also to everyone listening on WLNR. Keith, coming back to this, we were discussing the school consolidation crisis, as I'm calling it, here in Memphis, which is the fact that the Memphis City schools, which are 89 to 90% black, have surrendered the charter in order to turn the responsibility of the schools over to the Shelby County School Board. Now, there's one thing that's come up in all of this discussion of the charter and the surrender of the charter, and that is that Memphis City School System is what's called a special school district. And what does that mean?
Well, as you pointed out, the school system of default in, under Tennessee law is a county. The county, if no one else does, has to provide public education. So in most of Tennessee, which is rural, you just have a county school system for public education. Now, in Memphis, Memphis has long been at what they call a special school district. In other words, a school district within the county, which is smaller than the county. And this was done long ago, hidden in the midst of time, long before there were any racial issues involved. This was back in the days of segregation, probably back in the 1920s or so when this was first done. But now, racial dynamics have changed, and, you know, what we're seeing is a playing out of the perennial conundrum of black politicians, which is how do you get the white people's money without being hurt by the white people's votes. Now, when you get a situation like you have in Memphis and Shelby County, where blacks outnumber by a fairly large margin the white population, it's 65% to 35% in Memphis, Shelby County, combined, the second part of that paradigm is no longer a problem. But we do have, at least, you know, problematically for the black population in Memphis, this history of having a dual school system, a special school district for the city boundaries of Memphis, and then out in Shelby County, outside of the Memphis city limits, we have the county school system. Now, they are afraid of losing the white people's money because there's this constant conundrum in black-white relations in America. Blacks hate white people, but they understand that in order to live in a first-world environment, they have to live in the midst of a lot of white people, and they have to basically leech and sponge off of white money in order to provide the public services that make allow them to live in a first world environment. If they don't have access to that money for some reason, they start to become like Detroit or like Haiti, Bill.
Well, Keith, as you said, that this is a relationship of givers and takers, basically.
Parasite hosts.
Parasite hosts, whatever you want to call it. But obviously, in the case of of Shelby County, they have reached their limit of patience on this kind of thing. And so has the state of Tennessee, I might add. The state of Tennessee views Memphis as a deficit corner, a bottomless pit of debt. And so, as a result, has also taken action to prevent this immediate vote on school consolidation. Now, it's true also, I think we should mention, that the average student in the Memphis City schools gets $10,000 a year in funding on average,
plus,
and it's something I think in the neighborhood of $78,000 to $80,000 in the county, so a $2,000 difference per student.
Well, that would be a very conservative estimate. See, what you're talking about, Bill, is that they're, you know, Memphis is a very unique and singular type of place in the state of Tennessee. Tennessee is a majority white state. Memphis is the only major city in Tennessee that has a black majority population, and Shelby County is one of the few counties in Shelby County that has a black majority population. So Memphis basically has always been considered a world apart by the politicians in Nashville and the rural interests that dominate the rest of the Tennessee legislature. In fact, an old saying that used to be current around here is that the two largest cities in Mississippi are New Orleans and Memphis, and that the Delta began in the lobby of the Hotel Peabody in Memphis and ended on Catfish Row in Natchez. See, we're part of the Delta culture here, for better or worse, and we're totally different from the rest of Tennessee. And quite frankly, the rest of Tennessee has lost patience with Memphis. Most of Tennessee has Republican lawmakers. Memphis always sends a cadre of undereducated black legislators to Nashville who do nothing except race bait and stir up trouble all the time. So consequently, this is like the revenge of the rural white interests in Tennessee. They now are in control of the state legislature for the first time in about 100 years. And as a result of that, they're not shilly-shallying with Memphis at all. They're, you know, Memphis wants everybody to reason together so they can start using the pressure of political correctness to make their opponents cave in, but there's no stomach for that in Nashville right now, so it's really going to be interesting to see how this thing plays out. And, of course, you know, it will probably all be resolved in court, and we're going to see if the other shoe drops and the federal government gets involved in this, but right now it looks like the state government is going to trump the local, county, and city government.
Which has been long in coming, but I think you're right. Of course, whenever a civil rights group or a group that's been protected by civil rights cannot win at the ballot box, they take it immediately to the jury box. And, you know, to file in state court, federal court, whatever court they can get into, because they want to overthrow any attempt at an elected decision, you know, within whatever framework it is. I mean, that's the way that this has always worked.
Well, they don't really want the jury box. They want the imperial judge to make an appellate decision and exercise judicial review. That's their template for change ever since the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And right now it looks like we've got a conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, where conservatives have learned to play this game too, and there are a lot more conservative justices out there now than there were, let's say, 30 or 40 years ago. And as a result, it looks like the winning hand is held by the conservatives in this particular parlay right now. But it's going to be interesting to see how this thing plays out. But, I mean, the fact that there is a possibility of losing has the black leadership in Memphis as mad as a wet hen. Mayor Wharton is just sputtering mad about all of this. Of course, you know, he's now sounding like some old segregationist saying, you know, get these outlanders from the next level of government, which would be the state government, out of our local affairs here in Memphis, when back during the Civil Rights Movement, they couldn't wait for the even more distant federal government to get involved in their local affairs and the school board.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's a double standard when it concerns the interest of the civil rights generations. You know, those raised to believe that if you're not getting what you want, it's an injustice. You know, there's an injustice involved in every denial of benefits or subsidies.
They've been spoiled. They're expecting to win. They have won for the past 50 or 60 years, and the fact that they're on the threshold of losing just does not compute with them. You know, someone explained it to me this way the other day. Blacks have a zero-sum outlook when it comes to rights. They feel that before the integration movement, before civil rights movement, that they had no rights and whites had all the rights. They feel that now they have the rights.
And got a break. Got a break coming up. We'll be back. Nathan Bedford Forrest in the next half hour.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. To get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool, call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. Big girls don't cry.
Big girls don't cry. And welcome back, everybody. Bill Rowland here with Keith Alexander. Welcome to the second half hour. If you're just joining us, we were discussing school consolidation in Memphis, Tennessee, a local issue. And we're going to turn to another local issue, but with more national attention, I think. And that is the current flap that has been raised really by the media here in Memphis and around the country over a license plate issued in Mississippi commemorating Nathan Bedford Forrest. Certainly the greatest cavalry general of the American Civil War, the war between the states, depending on where you're from, but also a man who even was recognized by no less a figure than William Tecumseh Sherman as the greatest figure produced by either side during the war. And yet, of course, in the nature of things, being that we are now locked in a counterculture, a cultural revolution, really, that despises everything Southern, everything Confederate, and does everything to smear the Confederacy. The local media here has been conducting a running campaign against Nathan Bedford Forrest, rarely referring to him as a Confederate general, but only as the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, which is false, Keith.
Yeah, you know, I remember, Bill, when Obama was first elected president, you predicted two things. One is that there would be endless celebration of the civil rights movement, and that there would likewise be endless attacks on the Civil War heritage of the South. And again, you've proven to be prophetic. This is exactly what's going on. In Memphis, I find it ironic that this whole thing is being played out on the Fox channel here in Memphis. And, you know, Fox, this is supposed to be the conservative alternative, the home of Fox News and whatnot. But in Memphis, they have an almost all-black newscasting staff. And they decided with this flap that started about the Sons of Confederate Veterans of Mississippi wanting to have a Nathan Bedford Forrest license plate available to their members that they would pay a premium for, which would, of course, help the state of Mississippi financially, and all of the states need help financially now. Of course, this just, you know, this was the balloon going up for the left. They just have launched into a full court press against Nathan Bedford Forrest. And in particular, Channel 13 in Memphis, the Fox affiliate, had a two-evening series, Nathan Bedford Forrest, War Hero or War Criminal? And of course, they have concluded he's a war criminal, and that no decent person can have anything good to say about him, and quite frankly, they're really itching to tear down the statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest that exists in Forest Park in downtown Memphis, right next to the University of Tennessee Medical School, and, of course, dig up the graves of Forrest and his wife that are buried under the statue.
Well, fortunately, that's a violation of Tennessee law in about 10 different ways. So that won't happen. But nevertheless, the smear job continues and is being carried on a floating cloud. Named the Imperial Wizard of the Klan, but most people, they say he was the founder of the Klan, which is wrong, but what they don't say is that he was the one who abolished or did away with the Klan. That is, he said, "No, we're I'm abolishing." He disbanded it, and so you know that's not mentioned. It's also being claimed that he was a war criminal, and yet at no time after the war was Forrest ever charged with any crimes against what we call now crimes against humanity, war atrocities, all of that. Misinformation comes out of his action at Fort Pillow, where he had attacked the Union garrison there, and due to the actions of the Union garrison, it turned into a pretty bloody affair. But it was not a massacre, and again, this incident was investigated by no less a general than William Tecumseh Sherman, who certainly had no love of the South, and he determined that there was no criminal activity there or no behavior that was not in keeping with military law. So, once again, another lie simply to smear the memory of Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Well, you know, don't confuse them with the facts when it comes to a cultural icon. You know, they're after Forrest because he is a cultural icon. Let's break down some of the things they said about Nathan Bedford Forrest. And let's figure out what the truth is on these topics. First of all, it starts with the assumption that the Klan, particularly the Klan in its manifestation right after the Civil War, was all bad, all the time, 100% depraved, homicidal maniacs, okay? Well, the original Klan was formed to be a counter group to the original terrorists, which were called the Union League. The Union League was made up of former Union soldiers, a lot of whom were carpetbaggers that came down here, and they were mobilized by the North as a kind of paramilitary group to make black people vote for the Republicans and to terrorize blacks who did not vote Republican in local elections. They wanted to take control of the South. They had prohibited former Confederate soldiers and Confederate government officials from voting, which took most of the white males out of the equation. But even then, there was some loyalty among a lot of the black population in the South, and they weren't voting Republican, so the Union Leagues were trying to make them. They were also performing atrocities against the white population. In fact, the first Reconstruction governor of Tennessee was named Gerard Parson Brownlow. Brownlow was from Knoxville, Tennessee, which had basically remained a Union stronghold throughout the Civil War, and he had a newspaper called the Rebel Ventilator. Now, the ventilation that he referred to were bullet holes through ex-Confederates. This is what the reality was in Reconstruction Tennessee and in the Reconstruction South that you never hear referenced in today's history.
I just wanted to mention, too, that Parson Brownlow was a Democrat and pro-slavery. He was a pro-slave unionist and, yeah, and owned slaves himself. So, you know, they can't, if they try to make a hero out of Parson Brownlow, who really was a criminal in terms of his behavior towards civilians, would fall on his face because he did own slaves himself.
Right. There were all sorts of permutations of people back then. You had a unionist pro-slavery guy in Brownlow, for example, and that just doesn't fit with the modern mindset. You know, if you were pro-union, you had to be anti-slavery, but that just wasn't the case. You had all variations and colors of people with all sorts of, you know, a kind of fruit basket turnover of opinions back then. Now, regarding Fort Pillow, Fort Pillow was supposedly a massacre because they had black troops in the Union Army that performed very badly at Fort Pillow. Now, what happened at Fort Pillow was that these people, these Union colored troops, as they were called back then, had not been properly trained, weren't being properly led. And when the Confederates surrounded them and asked to surrender, they had a commander with very little experience who refused to surrender. So the Confederates charged. Then the frightened Union troops threw down their weapons and threw their hands up. But as the Confederates approached them, they would fall to the ground, pick up their weapons, and start firing. This is not the type of thing that endears one army to another army in time of war. But like you said, after the war, that they made a big thing about this in the northern newspapers because they wanted something to demonize the South with and really kind of stir things up. So they used this, and what happened was after the war they had a court-martial presided over by none other than William Tecumseh Sherman himself, a Union general who was Forrest's primary adversary during the war, who had no love lost between him and Forrest. And after hearing all the proof, he said that Forrest was guilty of no war crimes. And that should settle it, but instead we keep hearing about Fort Pillow. Just with the facts seems to be the approach of the cultural Marxist left.
Right. Well, they are the ones in possessions of the truth, even though we're the ones in possessions of the facts. And that's, right. That's how cultural Marxism works. They simply declare what the truth should be, and they proceed on that presumption that they hold the truth between their knees, even if you have it written down and documented. So we're about to go into a break. It's Bill Rowland and Keith Alexander coming up in the second hour. Brother Nathaniel.
They've took the home.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
And welcome back to the political cesspool. This is Bill Rowland sitting in for James Edwards tonight with my co-host, Keith Alexander, and we've been discussing Nathan Bedford Forrest, the career of Nathan Bedford Forrest, and the current media campaign against his memory and against his achievements. And Keith, I guess we'll wrap up now. Fox News has been the culprit in a lot of this smear campaign. They've been the primary culprit, actually, and that's surprising.
Well, they have a black newscaster who comes across in a kind of all-shucks manner named Ernie Freeman. Well, Ernie Freeman said in his epilogue, well, you know, we basically have tolerance in America now. We can either take or leave Nathan Bedford Forrest. I choose to leave him. I like my heroes less bellicose, less bloodthirsty, and less bigoted than Nathan Bedford Forrest. Well, first of all, trying to judge historical characters by today's standards of what is bigoted and what is not is absurd. Quite frankly, by today's standards, Abraham Lincoln would have been an arch segregationist. In the 1820s, the liberal position on what to do with black people in America was to ship them all back to Africa. Now, and by the 1930s, they had become the arch bigoted segregationist viewpoint held by Theodore Bilbo. See, that just shows you the absurdity of trying to judge historical figures by today's standards. Secondly, you know, if we can pick and choose our heroes, I choose not to venerate Martin Luther King. I don't care to venerate a man who was a serial adulterer, a communist sympathizer and operative, a man who was a physical and sexual abuser of women, and a plagiarizer. But he, alone among all past Americans, has a national holiday devoted to him and him alone, which shows you how the left has the upper hand. And see, all this stuff about Nathan Bedford Forrest is just another way of telling you who's in charge in America now. White people aren't in charge. The old history of white America is being put on the, down the memory hole of history. We're supposed to venerate people like Martin Luther King, and I have news for the left and for people who think that he should be venerated and the civil rights movement ought to be venerated. Moral paragons don't have to have their FBI files sealed for 50 years, which is exactly what a federal judge did right before they voted on the Martin Luther King holiday during the Reagan administration. Again, your great hero of conservatism, Reagan, was responsible for that, as well as the first amnesty for illegal aliens in America. You can't have the old heroes anymore. They're going to pull them down, and they're going to put up these new heroes. It's like being in a communist country where overnight a statue springs up to some new hero of the revolution. Well, Martin Luther King is supposedly a hero of the revolution, and just as you had predicted when Obama was elected, this is all part and parcel of what you had described, the veneration of the civil rights movement and the demonization of our Confederate history and basically any type of traditional American history. They're not satisfied to go after the Confederate history. They go after George Washington now. They renamed schools in New Orleans that had been named for George Washington or Thomas Jefferson because they were slaveholders. And as a result, they forfeited their humanity. They had nothing to offer. They were dead old white punks, and we've got to purge them from our national memory, and we've got to start worshiping the people that really were worthy of our admiration, like that two-legged dog, Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, certainly King dominates the holiday schedules as far as the calendar goes, because only King and Jesus get two holidays. So I think we ought to keep that in mind about who's the real deity in this country. Keith, I see you have a brochure announcing a big event coming here to Memphis, and one of I know a woman that you truly admire, is on the roster for that event, on the itinerary.
Yeah, we were talking about this. We're totally amazed at how pandering to the left and to the totems of the left, like the civil rights movement, like black-white race relations, pays in modern-day America. And the Toohey family of Memphis is exhibit one in this particular indictment. What has happened now, the Toohey's were a pair of gonzo sports fanatics, the type of people you see at private schools that were busily trying to get black athletes into their private school, thinking that that was going to make them the dominant player and the dominant team. And Sean Toohey was a former Ole Miss basketball player back in the day, and that was his unofficial role. He liked sending his kids to Briarcrest Christian School, where he could be a big fish in a small pond. He was in charge of bringing these black athletes in, but the problem was there was a little rule, TSSAA rule, Tennessee Secondary School Athletic Association rule, that said that if a kid gets a scholarship to a private school, it has to be paid by his parents or some other close relative, like an uncle or a grandparent or something like this. And if it isn't, they can go to the school. They just can't play major sports like basketball or football. Well, Sean Toohey didn't like hearing no. He's a big alpha male, the head of all the Kentucky Fried Chicken and Taco Bell franchises in Memphis. So he said, I'll show them, I'll adopt him. So he adopts him, and then he can do everything that a big booster wants to do for his protege black athlete, like give him a new car, give him new clothes, set him up in his house, living like a young prince. Well, the NCAA got suspicious of this, particularly when they managed to somehow raise his academic record magically so that he could qualify to go to Ole Miss. The NCAA investigator, who happened to be a black woman, came by. And at that point, the Toohey's reinvented themselves as civil rights heroes, and they've been running with it ever since. You had the Blind Side book written by his old classmate down at Cardinal Newman, or Isidore Newman Private High School in New Orleans, Michael Lewis. Then it became a hit movie, The Blind Side, which all the fundamentalists are just gaga over. And then finally, now we've got Leanne Toohey reincarnated as a motivational speaker at a business seminar, the Get Motivated Business Seminar, with all the regular, the usual suspects in neocon America: General Colin Powell, Lou Holtz, Rudy Giuliani, Steve Forbes, Laura Bush, yada, yada, yada. Okay, Terry Bradshaw, his brilliance, I'm sure, will shine forth. These are the new heroes of America, and this is what has come. You know, that you have a pair of grifters that basically just escaped the NCAA's punishment procedures, and they've been able to convert themselves into these demigod-like figures. They're now Saint Leanne and Saint Sean.
The interesting thing, of course, is that she has cast her lot with the neocons and apparently with the money. I mean, certainly the Toohey's are not people who are going to allow a financial opportunity to pass them by. They're going to get some of their investment back from the money they put into Michael Oher. And by the way, he did a book signing here in Memphis. He has written a book. Keith, quick note on that before we go to break.
Yeah, basically in the Blind Side book, it's told from the Toohey's standpoint. They're the great heroes. Without them, this boy would have languished and probably become a drug dealer or would have been in an early grave. Well, Michael Oher took exception to this. Now he has written his own book saying, I was a survivor, I was a winner, and I would have made it with or without the Toohey's. And, of course, they're trying to paper over that particular fissure between their relationship. But, obviously, he didn't like the fact that the Toohey's were catching all the bouquets based on his life story.
I think that's the interesting point of all of this is, of course, the Blind Side movie is all about glorifying white liberalism and the self-sacrifice of white liberals for these poor, underprivileged black urban youth. And now, once that grand experiment has taken place and Michael Oher has turned out to be the big success, he's now going to claim his own ground and say they didn't have anything to do with it. That's really what he's saying. That wasn't really them. They just gave me a place to stay while I was on my way up.
See, you know, one, it shows ingratitude of Michael Oher and people like him. Then, on the other hand, it shows you basically that there's a reason why Hollywood and the media elite embrace this story. You know, they will never accept defeat. After 40 years of affirmative action and every expenditure that you can imagine, the Memphis City is awash in money, according to Kenneth Whalen, one of the school board members, but they still have all F's on their school report card from the state. Admit defeat, and now they're trying to talk credulous white people into adopting black underclass kids and bringing them into their homes. That's what the Brian side is all about.
Okay. First hour's over, Keith. And thanks to Keith Alexander for coming in. We'll be back in the next hour. Brother Nathaniel.
To go. Stay tuned. Hour number two of the Political Cesspool comes your way right after these messages.
And Harv leaped to his feet and says, something's got a hold on me. The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting hallelujah. Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of blooms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the amen.